This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
I'm Nam Kim. I am a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I am an archaeologist and anthropologist by trade, and I am a Korean Vietnamese American, and it's wonderful to be on this podcast to be talking with the both of you.
Hi all, my name is Tuan Lee. I'm a Vietnamese Korean living in Los Angeles. I'm the CEO and founder of Vervet, a sparkling craft cocktail company that's venture-backed. My background includes, my father is from Busan and my mother is from Dalat. And I was born in Saigon and came to America when I was 3 years old.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you both. I've been waiting for months to get this interview with both of you going because there is a huge intersection between the Korean culture and the Vietnamese culture. And what more better way to have both of you representing both Korea and Vietnam on this podcast. There's so much to talk about. So thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So Tuan, let me start by asking you and then we'll go to Nam. Historically, do you know of any ancient relationships between Korea or Vietnam or even modern day relationships between Korea and Vietnam?
Ancient, less so. I mean, you know, of course, I think all of us, you know, our mother country is China. So I'm sure we all share our roots back to there.
Them are fighting
modern. Yeah, I think in modern times, our relationship is very interesting. It was, you know, from what I know, and I'm sure Nam can add more information to this. But our relationship, I think last century was born out of the conflict in Vietnam, outside of the U.S. government. Korea provided the largest military force in Korea. And that really was kind of the beginning of a more strategic, our strategic relationship was to help the efforts of the South Vietnamese army as they were trying to unify the government, you know, under their ideologies. And now in modern times, and from what I understand, Korea might be the top one or two largest foreign investor in Vietnam today.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. I can speak a little bit about the more ancient context. This is an area that I have some familiarity with. I mean, we can go very far back to something like 2000 plus years ago and talk about maybe there wasn't a Vietnam or a Korea as we can see today, but we can see various communities in these areas that were impacted by interactions throughout these neighboring regions. And then the elephant in the room, as Tuan mentioned, is an emerging Chinese civilization and the various impacts that the imperial Qin dynasty, the Han, would have had on the Red River Delta area in northern Vietnam, in the Korean Peninsula. So there are lots of connections that we can trace back to that time period, probably interactions that traversed throughout the entire region across the seas. I think there's a very interesting historical episode from later, from the second millennium. So maybe it's something like the 13th century. There is a story of one of the princes of the Li dynasty who was on a ship that may have been blown off course, may have over Korean shores by accident. That I think is debated. But from what I understand, the prince stays and actually maybe is welcomed by the local kingdom, the Goryeo dynasty, maybe even participated in repelling some of the invasions by the Mongols. And from what I understand, descendants of that individual are still in Korea. through today. And they trace their ancestry back. So they talk about their lineages. And so they're celebrated as very early diaspora of the Viet in other areas of Asia. And I think there are some relationships even right through to the 21st century. So they recognize this sort of historical lineage. And then, of course, Tuan was talking about all of the 20th century connections. From my own personal history, there is a clear connection between the two because of conflicts that happened during the 20th century. Like I shouldn't exist. I shouldn't be here had it not been for those conflicts. But there is this kind of parallel in terms of civil war and post-war, post-colonial context that both of these cultures and countries share that's fascinating to consider.
No, it's very fascinating. Now, how, you said 1300s was the prince, and how did you spell his name? L-E or L-E-E or?
I think it's L-Y.
L-Y. Yeah. And does that have anything to do with L-E-E with the Korean last name, or did they keep it separate?
That I'm not clear about. I think that there might be some connections, simply because I from what I've read, one of those descendants, I believe, spells the name in the anglicized version, L-E-E. But I don't know if in Korean or in other contexts, if they're the same, if they have the same origin. There might be other Lees.
And was there a big population, like, you know, the way Genghis Khan, you know, had produced all this offspring? Was there anything like that with this prince that came?
I don't know for sure. I don't think it'd be on the scale of what I've heard about, right, about Genghis Khan. But I think the number that I saw was something like in the hundreds or like 1,000 in terms of total descendants that might still be in Korea today. But this is all tangential information. I don't research this. It's just stuff that I've read in passing.
Growing up, now, did you ever foresee this massive influx of Korean culture, Vietnamese culture to the West, to the way we are perceiving Korean culture and Vietnamese culture? Did you kind of like anticipate it coming?
No. I mean, that's just a simple answer. No.
Yeah.
Growing up, it was all around me, right, in my household and in the communities that I lived in. But the kind of influence that I could not anticipate, I did not foresee.
Yeah.
In fact, it was the opposite. I felt as though we were very much on the fringe. I mean, and I don't know if it's the same for you guys, but wherever I went, people would ask me, are you Chinese? You know, where are you from? That was sort of the assumption. Non-Asian communities, I should say, would ask that question. So it was almost a sort of relegation to a smaller category or being invisible almost. So to see the way it's happening, the way it's transpired over the last decade or so, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah. Tuan?
Oh, absolutely. As a kid, I certainly was not optimizing my life towards a Vietnamese Korean golden age in the future in America. Let alone an Asian American golden age in America. No, absolutely. I was learned real quickly in grade school and middle school. I better optimize my life towards, you know, the larger group's definition of assimilation, you know, really sort of becoming, adopting the existing and dominant culture, adopting their values and adopting their likes and upholding their aspirations. So that's what I was optimizing before. And it wasn't until later in the, you know, probably my 20s in college courses when I really, that was kind of when the seeds, you know, were planted and I was becoming passionate about, you know, advocating for our community in small ways. But even then through my 20s, it was still very difficult and very challenging to be really strong and courageous about it.
When I think of both of you and your cultural backgrounds, I think what's better than one jet engine? Two jet engines. It's phenomenal, like, to think of how far the Korean culture has come and now the Vietnamese are coming up. You know, what does that feel like for you both?
Nam?
By the way, I love that analogy, the two jet engines. I'm gonna remember that, and I'm gonna use that. It's sort of a mixed bag. In a way, it's been very complicated, I think, and this is probably the case for most people that are immigrants that come to a new adopted home country and have multiple backgrounds, multiple cultural backgrounds and ancestral roots in various places and connections still to these communities. But to have this sort of tripartite kind of cultural background, right? Learning to be American at the same time as one's family. So as the same time as my parents were learning to be American, learning the language, the customs, in some ways trying to preserve elements of the other cultures in our background, in our ancestry, but embracing the new and trying to blend in, to become part of the new fabric. There's a delicate tension there. There's a balance that you have to strike. So there were challenges, but as you point out, now with experience, with age, and with wisdom, you start to see the kinds of opportunities that all of that hardship now present to you. And I've tried to embrace that in ways that get changed, that evolve over time. But a lot of my research now has revolved around this background, has revolved around that kind of ancestry and opportunity. So I'm privileged now to be able to work and do field work in Vietnam. So when we left Vietnam, we had no inkling that we would have any kind of relationship back with the country. But to be able to now work there, it's just been phenomenal.
Tuan?
Yeah, I love the analogy too. And when I think, you know, within your analogy, and I think about it through that lens, having these two engines, right, is like having two cultural parents, you know, or guides, and they couldn't be more different, you know, that sort of powers this plane. You know, Korean culture, you know, really adopted a sort of methodical and scientific measure three times, cut once, you know, and it kind of goes back. We have roots in that to, you know, King Sejong, who really began a scientific method in creating our alphabet, which we can talk about later. And then I have on the other side, the Vietnamese engine, which is sometimes just so instinctual. And they're just in their feelings and in their emotions, you know, and they're like, let's just meow, let's go, you know, and it's let's just do it. And, you know, and it's, and I'm speaking in generalizations, but overall, what the experience is for me when you sort of combine it is, you know, a sense of pride that I just never really experienced before. I had a friend that joked with me within the last like 2 years, being Vietnamese and Korean. I mean, this is what it must be feel like to be a, you know, Italian and French, you know, these sort of like two aspirational cultures, but, you know, but overall I'm very proud to represent both. And, you know, it's really is kind of as a goal of mine to do that well.
Did you both grow up in households where you were able to witness the two cultures going back and forth, interacting, or sort of you weren't, and you just kind of like picked up the two cultures as a result of having friends that were all Korean or all Vietnamese?
Well, for me, it was a little bit of both. I grew up speaking Vietnamese with my mother and Korean with my dad. And also they use a kind of hybrid language that today incorporates both languages and English. But the kinds of cultural values and customs came from both sides. But as I got older, I started to run in different circles with Vietnamese Americans, with Korean Americans. And I got, they seldom were the same circle at least from my experience, but I got a sense from both. And so to answer your question, it was a combination of experiences that gave me glimpses into the world. But I think to one's point earlier, very different experiences. The kinds of experiences, the kinds of attitudes. I remember distinctly as a child meeting some of my father's friends. We lived in this heavily Korean American community in Chicago, the north side of Chicago. But meeting some of his friends, they would always have these interesting conversations with me that opened up with, well, how's your Korean coming along? You, by the way, you know that you're Korean, right? You know this, right? So it was a sort of inside joke, but I didn't know if they were actually joking or not. I don't think some of them were joking. And I made my first trip to South Korea back in the 1980s with my father, just the two of us. And I remember meeting my relatives on that side, but same kind of sentiment came from them. It was sort of the opposite with my mother's side. So that experience was a lot more open. And I don't know how much of that has to do with recent history or the context in which people came to the US as immigrants. But that was the kind of experience that I had.
For me growing up, I would say no, I wasn't really able to experience both cultures at the same time and experience kind of a synergy from that. I grew up with my mom. My mom and dad ended up separating. And so I wasn't able to spend a lot of time in the Korean household. But prior to that, I wish I would have, because I asked my mom and dad all the time, well, my dad's no longer with us. But, but they would tell me about their relationship, and because they had three languages and that's how they would communicate. My dad was learning Vietnamese, my mom was learning Korean, and then they had English. And between all of those three language channels is how they built their relationship over the period of, 6.5 years until they separated. So I missed out on that. I was too young. And of course, I wasn't born for half of it. But it's interesting, my parents did reconnect when I was in my 20s and began to spend time with one another here in Los Angeles. And it was really fun to see them interact. Wow. My Korean side of the family, they love Vietnamese food. So I think for them, that was one of the things they were most excited about, engaging with the Vietnamese side of the family. With my mom, like if she would make some Vietnamese food. So and, to this day, when I am with my Korean family here, oftentimes they're what they want to do to go out to eat is like, let's go to a Vietnamese restaurant.
Wow. Wait, I got to stop. So they get back together or they just sort of hang out because of you? They're not romantically, back together at when they get reacquainted.
Well, I think when they became reacquainted, it was probably a little mix of both. There was some nostalgia there. I mean, I think the trauma of the war and everything else that sort of led to their separation, there was just a lot of drivers in there. And that's a whole nother podcast for another time. But I think for them to see each other again, yes, I think, because of me and just being able to share that. And but at the same time, for them to reconnect and after, some time lost and sort of build upon that and see themselves in as more mature humans. And during this time, I think they had a really wonderful time until my father passed away. And it was partly romantic and friendship, sharing a child together. I think all of that really led to, to their interest in spending time with one another.
Nam and I are fighting for the next question. Go ahead, Nam.
I'm fascinated.
Yeah, I am too.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Yes, of course.
So I'm very curious how your folks met and when and what circumstances.
My father, was one of the a group. There was a group of Korean businessmen who went to Vietnam and there to support the interests of the government, to provide commodities, like everything from socks to bread, you know, in support of the war effort there. And while he was there, you know, he met my mom at a restaurant, and he approached her. You know, I have no idea how he hit on her. Like, I have no idea what language. I just asked my mom, like, just last week, like, what did he say to you? And, you know, she was trying to remember. At that time, my mom had left Dalat, right? And she went to the big city to look for her opportunities. She was in her early 20s and ready to begin her life there. And she was working at a bank at the time. So that's how they began their relationship. You know, their romance began during the war. It was a military, you know, and they had got together and married and started a family. And, you know, Nam, I connected with what you had said. I'm very lucky to be here. How we were able to escape Vietnam is because of the Korean embassy. And they had an asset, a ship, and we were on the very, very last ship out of Vietnam.
Wow. So, okay, I don't want to take up the...
Nam, there's no host here. This is a group conversation. You fire away. This is the reason why we're here. It's okay. For you and Tuan to ask questions. I'm a fly on the wall right now. I just want to hear, you know, my ears are just sort of like, it's enjoying itself. So you guys go do your thing.
I appreciate that. Because when you were talking, Tuan, so many questions are swimming through my head at the moment. Because from what you've described, I have similar stories from my folks about when they met and how they met and the experience that they had. But the one thing you just said, I find fascinating, because when you left through the Korean embassy, was that in April of 75?
It was.
Okay. So my suspicion is we had just missed that boat. My parents and I. I can go back if we want to talk about that further, about when he got to Vietnam, but so they got married in 73 in Saigon. And at that point, he had originally come to work as a business person as well in Vietnam. But he ended up becoming part of or working with the Korean embassy. I think he was doing photojournalism for them. So he was very much in that world. And so I was born in 74. In April of 75, the writing was starting to be on the wall. And I think he was trying to figure out if we were going to go with that evacuation of the Korean embassy. The problem was my mother wasn't ready to go. She was the youngest in her family and didn't know what was happening with everybody else, all her siblings, her parents, et cetera. She didn't know if she wanted to leave. And it took them, my grandparents, convincing her, you've got a baby, you have a chance to get out of here, go. But by the time they decided to do that, the embassy had already evacuated.
Wow. We have such a similar story tied to the same timeline under a lot of pressure. So interestingly enough, my mom and dad, at first, the Korean embassy was sending out messages as much as they could update. Back in that day, there was no digital communications then. Updating on the war, but the message of the day is time to evacuate, and there's a limited number of ships leaving. So if you're not on these, you're going to remain here, and whatever happens, happens. And so there was pressure. At that time, there was so much confusion. There was an opportunity to leave on another ship with my parents and I, you know, the Korean government, you have children here, you know, so you're prioritized to have a spot.
Yeah.
And, there was one thought being floated that this was temporary, and so my dad was going to leave and then come back to Vietnam. You know, it's like, let's just let this dust settle. We don't know what's happening with the American forces and actually what they're doing, but we understand that it's going to be temporary and I'll come back.
Yeah.
And within his Korean community, they began talking like, hey, there's something's off here. I think this is pretty serious, you know. Yeah. And so my dad came back and, you know, sat my mom down. It's like, I think we have to leave immediately, you know, because I don't think this is temporary. And this is there's only one more boat. and this is it. And so we have to go. And that was in the morning. My mom describes it as like she had just like 2 hours to like grab everything and make plans and just leave immediately. Okay. And my sister at the time was actually not in Saigon, and she was in Dalat, and there was no time to travel to Dalat or for her to like, how does she get here? It's a couple hours away travel then. And we have to leave now because the boat is leaving. So it was, that was a very wild day.
Yeah. Yeah. I cannot imagine what it was like for them, the decision-making process, how desperate things were. From what I understand, we went to the Korean embassy and there was a note on the gates saying, "We're gone. You missed it," right? But it said to go to, and I think it might have listed a couple of other possibilities. We tried to go to other places, got turned away. But the one place we did get into was the USA compound. That's where we ended up. So we went there. My dad was able to flash his press credentials and got us through the gate. So we got inside. But to an earlier point you were saying, there was this really interesting scene inside, where a lot of folks thought that it was temporary, not only temporary, but they were just hanging out. They were by the pool, they were raiding the kitchen. I think they were getting drunk. And they were saying, you know, the Americans are right out there on the shore. They're coming back. This is not over, right? We're gonna be okay. And they were convinced that nobody had to panic or leave. But I think there was a local security guard or soldier who saw my parents with me and called my parents over and said, "Why don't you go downstairs to the basement?" They didn't explain why, but they said, "Just go down to the basement." So we went down, and there was a tunnel that led to another part of the compound. And once we got there, there was a line of people in the stairwell going up to the top. And they knew that helicopters were to be coming in and ferrying people off the rooftop away. And that's ultimately how we got out. And I think this was Operation Frequent Wind, is that what the U.S. government and I think it was the Marines were running. But we eventually then got out by helicopter, leaving Saigon.
Yeah, wow, that is, it just reinforces how precarious and how risky the situation was, and completely out of our hands, luck and intervention by strangers, you know, how this really all happened. And, you know, as I continue to get older, I just think about all of those moments, and it easily could have gone a different direction. You know, had my mom and dad, and particularly my father, who was really driving the decision, you know, decided to believe one thought that was going around, one theory, that this was temporary and there's nothing to worry about, they're right over there, you know, our lives would be completely different.
Yeah.
And instead, he made a choice, you know, that was, you know, to be safe. And that's the decision. And it was at the very last minute, he decided to do that. And it would have gone the other way.
No.
Tuan, you didn't grow up with your father, right? Like, how many years did you spend with him? Up until you met him again?
Up until 3. You know, we went to Busan after that, and we were received there. We were there for a very short amount of time. And that's where my parents separated. The circumstances, and I'll tell you, I can share it, but essentially what was discovered is, and this is on my dad, on the ship on the way to Busan, they were married, and you got to understand, they were together for 6 years at this point. And my dad had gone to Vietnam thinking this where he was going to live. And especially after meeting my mom and starting a family, but you know, he made some personal choices that, you know, he had to live with the consequences. And one of the news that he shared with my mom was, I need to tell you something. I'm still married in Korea. I have a wife and children from that marriage. I'm sorry I didn't tell you before. but I better tell you now because we're going to be in Korea, you know, in a few weeks. So that really, the dominoes began to fall in my mom's head, and she was beginning to process this. And we were in Busan and met my father's, you know, second wife and that family. And my mom's like, oh boy, this is not going to go well. And so she made a painful decision to end the marriage. And well, not even really end the marriage. I don't think it was really spoken in that terms, but it was like, hey, this isn't going to work, you know, instead I'm going to go to America. You know, I can't believe she made that decision on her own. She was in her middle 20s and she knew no one. And she knew that was a better option for her and me. And against this one, as she put the two choices on the scales. And after that, you know, my father came to America. They stayed in touch, through letters kind of over the years. My mother had remarried when she got to the United States. She needed support, you know, she was figuring out how to survive. And so a kind of a new life began, and we just kind of had this in like my engagement with my father was basically through just letters. And then after college, you know, then there was a more intentional choice, like, hey, let's reunite, you know, everyone. And you know, at that point.
Yeah. So I guess I asked that because once you get reunited and they, you know, they hang out with each other, and you get to see the dynamic, did it make sense to you? Like, what were you thinking at that time?
Did their marriage make sense to me?
No, just the sort of the cultural pairing. Like, did any of that make sense? Like, sometimes you see people and you're like, oh, that makes a lot of sense why they're together. You know, they come from very different places. And I'm wondering, you haven't been around your father for all those years. You haven't witnessed sort of his cultural side, and you know, once you see these grown-ups together and if this is like half of your DNA, did it make sense or did it not make any sense at all when the
things clicked?
There is
sort of like these cultural similarities between, you know, my father and I, like similar behaviors, and so that sort of clicked. I think seeing them, their relationship together was really wonderful. It was, you know, they're adults, we see our, you know, but they were so playful with one another.
Really? Wow.
You know, my dad would ask her, hey, remember that song? Can you sing that song that we used to listen to? And, you know, my parents really enjoyed, you know, going out to eat like all of us Asians. I mean, that was one thing that they really did a lot. So they were really able to do that, you know, have Vietnamese food. And many, many things clicked. And a lot of unanswered questions, you know, that was everything that I was, you know, dealing with and developing as a person, you know, all of that. There was, you know, our lives, you know, everyone here was born in trauma and processing all of that and reconnecting with my father, asking questions, having conversations. Yeah, a lot of dots were connected, you know, and that really informed who I was. My identity, a lot of forgiveness and understanding, challenges, and today, to this day, like, I'm just so amazed at both of them, how they were able to not only just survive but figure out a way to thrive and take care of me.
And Nam, I know you grew up with your parents side by side. You know, what were the cultural sort of similarities and the differences that you experienced in your family?
You know, that's interesting. I didn't think about it so much from a cultural perspective as a child. I just thought I saw two people. They clicked in terms of personality, both with a nice sense of humor, both having survived very traumatic childhoods. And my suspicion is that part of that was what drew them together, right? So maybe when they met, maybe they couldn't speak each other's languages very well, or maybe even at all. Tuan, I sympathize with you. I asked my parents this question too. How did you communicate when you first met? It's still kind of a mystery to me. But what I think is they had very similar backgrounds. And it kind of reflects the similar histories of struggle, of resistance, of being kind of the underdog, right? If we think about what happens in the Korean Peninsula and in Vietnam with the Japanese, with the French, with the end of World War II, with the civil wars, everything. I think they were drawn to each other. Both families had to run when they were kids. Both were separated and then reacquainted with people, with places. Both had to leave things behind. And then after they met each other, they had to go through that again, right? The two of them together. So they experienced the same kinds of things. So there was a bond that formed with them that I think very few couples can share. And this permeated through, you know, my childhood. I heard of all these stories. I credit those stories and that kind of background with what I do now. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that I made certain decisions throughout my life. Maybe I didn't see it at the time, but I, looking back on it now, I know exactly why I got interested in the kind of things that I do now. So I think that's what I saw mostly. I didn't see so much the Korean and the Vietnamese parts or the similarities and differences. What I saw were two people who shared this kind of life history, this experience.
Wow. No, you really nailed it and expressed it so well. Kenneth, that is absolutely true. I think both of our fathers, I'm sure we're all aware here of the impact of the Japanese invasion and colonization. It left Korea so incredibly impoverished, not just financially, but morally and culturally. Because there, you know, another topic, but there was a really systemic and methodical erasure of the destruction of Korean culture, books, monuments, everything, as the Japanese were trying to erase it all and replace themselves. But economically speaking, devastation. My father was so poor. It was so poor. And there was no opportunities in Korea. Food was scarce. And that was what drove him to Vietnam to figure out how he can survive, you know? And he had gone through this, and he's going into another country that was currently undergoing a struggle. And then for that to happen, yes, absolutely. Here it is. Now I'm escaping and running again, although for different reasons. But these survival instincts, you know, and that he was able to bring that into the relationship with my mom. Like, wow, this is, here we go again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's eerily similar.
Yeah.
And I remember asking him about his childhood. He would tell me about how I don't know how old your father was or what year he was born, but my dad was born in the early 30s. So he was experiencing in his childhood the Japanese occupation. He had a Japanese name that was assigned to him. He wasn't permitted to speak Korean in school. And he was growing up in a very poor, impoverished environment as well. So his hometown was right up where the DMZ is now, near the 30th parallel. And after the Japanese exit the picture, he remembered vividly new powers coming into the picture, Soviets, the Americans, others, and then the borders beginning to form. And then when conflict started, things just moving back and forth, these waves. And this was interesting for me to hear about because in his words, everyone in the community didn't know what was going on exactly. They didn't know anything about the ideological basis for the new governments, the conflict that was about to start. They didn't know whose side they should be on. They started to not trust each other, their neighbors even, who might get reported to certain authorities and so forth. And he got separated from his family and then survived all of that, right? He was homeless, ended up as a refugee as a teenager, but then ended up fighting in the war too. But then to go from that environment to Vietnam, I remember asking him, how was it that you went to Vietnam? Why did you go to another place that was experiencing conflict and turmoil as well? And I don't know if he said it exactly in these words, but the sense I got from him was that felt like home to him. He was comfortable in that kind of chaotic environment. So when he was separated from family, his fellow soldiers and others in that environment, that became his de facto family, right? That was his surrogate family. And he became comfortable in that environment. So he had no anxiety about going to this place, albeit for business at that time in the 60s, but no reservations about it, despite the pleas of others to tell him, you shouldn't go. You shouldn't be there.
Absolutely. Same with my father. My father was born in the late 1930s. So he also experienced, Japanese colonization and the impacts that you described. And also the paranoia that you described too, where neighbors didn't really trust each other. It was sort of fear-based and scarcity mindset. And going to Vietnam was like, you know, was something familiar. And in his judgment, it's better than this. Than what he was experiencing. And even though there was, it was chaos in both countries, but the chaos in Vietnam to him had more opportunity than in Korea. So it is, I think about that often, and, you know, and what's in all of us, both of us, you know, you and Nam too. And I think all of us, even Vietnamese, like, the ability to survive and really kind of what's in our cultural DNA and how strongly tied that is to us today.
I'm curious to hear about your grandparents and how they sort of interacted with their counterparts, the Korean counterparts, the Vietnamese counterparts, what it was like if you knew in the early days of their sentiments towards the in-laws and what it is today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Well, I'll begin because it's short. My father's parents and my mother's parents never met. And my father had a very complicated relationship with his parents. So he didn't like to talk about it too much. And so I think there was, you know, some conflict and some generational, you know, areas where they just did not have a shared reality.
My grandparents on both sides never met either. My father's father passed away when he was quite young. During the Korean War, he was separated from his mother. She ended up dying before he ever saw her again. Now, in Vietnam, he actually did meet with my mother's parents. They were still around. She was, as I mentioned before, the youngest in the family. So she was the baby. She was oop in the family. And they joke about this. I remember them telling me, since I was a kid, how it took the courtship something like 3 or 4 years before he got acceptance. They were secretly dating, then they were openly dating, and they were recruiting brothers and other family members to see the value in him and all this stuff because the parents had issues. The joke was he was a foreigner. He was overweight and ugly, and they would have no future, right? Because of all of those reasons. But he started to grow on them. And I think what they realized was that he was very serious about providing for her. And there was a promise that he made. There was one conversation he had with his future father-in-law before they got the blessing. And what he promised him was any opportunities our children will be more than whatever we've had. They will be just as educated. They'll be just as provided for and privileged. And I'm going to guarantee that. That was the promise he made. And I think that won over my grandfather. And then he convinced the grandmother to come along at that point. But that was something that my father openly talks about. He experienced prejudice, not just from the family, the prospective family, but also from local Vietnamese. I don't know, Tuan, if the same applies in your dad's case, but he experienced prejudice locally in Saigon. And they would often go outside of the city to meet with one another, not just to avoid being seen by family, but by locals, because they experienced looks, they experienced words, because of his status as a foreigner. So that relationship was very much frowned upon locally. And that it extended even beyond that, even during their experiences in refugee camps. And I can talk about that later on, but I'm curious if your dad experienced similar things.
Yeah, absolutely. As a foreign group, you know, Koreans don't enjoy the status they have today in modern Vietnam. You know, at that time, yeah, it was, you know, absolutely similar, you know. So my mom and dad, they just really socialized within the Korean community that had also had Vietnamese partners. And that was their social group, you know. My dad had met my mom's parents too as well. And I, you know, from what I get a sense is that my mom was the last of seven children. And I think that time they were really exhausted and they were like, okay, she found someone that really loves her and is really dedicated and committed to taking care of her. And so I think during that time, given everything that was going on, they were of the mind like, okay, this is good. This is the best, you know, that we could hope for, you know, is that she found someone, she's married, and you know, we don't have to worry about our youngest daughter because we're dealing with so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I feel like such a simpleton going into this next question, but this is really why I'm here. This next question. It's as simple as it sounds and as juvenile as the question is, I really am curious to hear both of your perspectives on the strengths and the weaknesses of both cultures. I know that's going to put you guys in a tough spot or hot water.
Such a tough spot.
But I got to go for it, man. I built the whole podcast around this question and I am dying to know. And actually we're almost an hour in, believe it or not.
Wow.
But you know, this is the first question that I should have asked so we could get it out of the way, but here we are. I really am dying to know from your perspectives the weaknesses and the strengths of each one. Long awkward pause.
You go first, Nam. It's like, let's light up the comment section. Let's go.
Maybe we can go back and forth. I'll take a crack at it. You know, that's a very, very difficult question. Especially for me as an anthropologist who deals with culture and studies of different cultures, past and present, and even future, right? I'm kind of reluctant to make blanket generalizations.
Yeah.
However, to humor you as our illustrious host, one of the strengths that I see is, and it goes back to something that we were talking about earlier, is this sort of resilience, right, in terms of struggle. I think the Korean culture prides itself in this. I think the Vietnamese culture prides itself in this, at least as many people as I've been able to meet and talk to, and what they've experienced in recent history. And when I say recent, maybe we're talking about the last century or so. But the struggle against adversity, against foreign powers and intervention, all this stuff, that kind of endurance of hardship, I think is a common theme that I see in both cultures. Now, it's not restricted to just these two cultures. We can look all around the world and see all kinds of communities who talk about this or who feel that way. But there is a certain kind of pride. And I think there are certain terms even in some of these societies in Korean and Vietnamese culture that very explicitly talk about the ability to resist, the ability to endure all that pain, all that hardship. And they will cite all that recent history as evidence, as data for that characteristic, right? It's part of the society, part of the culture. So to me, that would be a strength.
Yeah, you took the diplomatic approach first. I see what you did there, Tuan.
Okay. I'll indulge. Okay, so the strengths and weaknesses, in generally speaking, the for Korea, I would say is, I think with anything, one of the what drives success of any type of enterprise, large or small, is ops, right? Operations, I think, is really, really great, and I think that's something Korea did an incredible job at, going from the bottom GDP to where they are now, and how strong they are culturally, their cultural value. The internal operations of that company, led by the government, has done a really great job, right? And it's really protected internal efforts to let the internal entrepreneurs and creativity flourish to the strength that you see today. So they really do protect foreign intervention in the business community and cultural community in favor of what's happening inside the country. For example, in Vietnam, there's Maru chocolate, which is like, two white guys originally from France. That wouldn't happen in Korea, as to see that sort of profiteering sort of taking place and taking advantage of one of Vietnam's natural resources and cacao and having the entire upside go to foreigners, right? So that wouldn't happen. And how that is sort of communicated and presented, all of that would that the PR and the cultural credit is well managed, by the country. I think one weakness of Korean culture is while I do appreciate the solidarity of this country, which has driven their success. On one hand, I think they're just at risk of, the negative effects of nationalism when you become too monocultural. And so there's issues of sort of discrimination there, and that they are going through right now. So that's a weakness. And I think when it comes to Vietnam, again, the resilience, what Nam said, is definitely a strength. Vietnamese people, despite the horrific trauma, I cannot believe how warm and fun-loving they are, and driven to rebuild community, and so quick with just a smile and wanting to give back and have a sense of joy in their lives. Like, I cannot believe, their energy when it comes to that. And I think one of the things when I think about Vietnam where it could really sort of improve is, I think, Kenneth, you and I were talking, it's not like, if you're going to chop wood, spend 3 hours sharpening your axe and then spend that last hour chopping the wood, right? It's sort of the opposite. Who cares? Let's just do it. Let's just go chop. And I think that's an issue. I think the infrastructure and the operations of Vietnam is just sort of all over the place. I feel like they're more concerned with like vanity metrics, which has no impact on the outcome. Let's go censor a YouTube because he said something mean about us, about the government. Who cares? And when there's time is better spent and resources are better spent, I think strengthen up that the internal structures and infrastructure. And I think at the time, like, we're just so fragmented. I think Vietnamese within the country, from north, central, south, down to the Mekong Delta, and the entire Vietnamese diaspora, don't have a shared history. They all have, it is completely, they don't really sort of share a what is Vietnamese history. And share an identity of what it means to be Vietnamese and part of the diaspora. And that is just really hard, I think, when you're trying to create momentum and to drive towards a V wave, which is the goal.
That's a great point. Not only do we have to contend with North, Central, and South, but now we have to contend with diaspora in America, diaspora in Paris, diaspora in Australia. It's all very different. And the shared history is very different. The perception of a shared history is almost non-existent. They all think that they're falling under the banner of Vietnam, but it's a million different wild parties here.
Yeah, it's highly diluted.
Highly diluted. And that's probably, I
Absolutely.
never thought about that in that terms. And that's why it's so hard to get this locomotive to move its to move the body of the whole train because it's just, you know, all over the place.
I mean, it's not just diluted, it's contested.
Right. It's contested.
It depends on who you talk to, where they come from specifically, where they might have hailed from, their views, not just about the longer term ancient past, but about the recent past.
Right.
Because you've got folks who would say, well, there's a different Vietnam that I came from. The Vietnam I came from doesn't exist anymore. I mean, to put it into blunt terms, I don't have a birth certificate. I don't have any documentation that I existed as an infant because the country that I was born in doesn't exist anymore. But the heritage is there. And I guess this gets into how it's a matter of dilution, but also very complex layers, because we can talk about shared ancestry and shared history, shared cultural values or language, customs, whatever the case might be, that permeates through many people of Vietnamese ancestry today, whether in the country or outside of it in various places around the world. But then depending on local histories or circumstances, that dilution happens. Some of it happened the moment you left, or the moment your families or ancestors or grandparents might have left the country. That happens in the new places that you are located now, whether you intend for it to happen or not. But because of that, that shared sense of what it is to be Vietnamese is highly diluted. And
highly diluted and completely different. And I think that's a huge difference, because after the unification in taking place in South Korea, what happened is, you know, leveraging internal structures like the public education and textbooks to make sure that all Koreans are on the same page of the facts of history, and then providing other services to rebuild, you know, documentations of your birth, everything, you know. So we sort of we lack that, I think, in Vietnam. And you know, you talk to people and, you know, they're, everything is just all over the place. So many assumptions, not enough facts. You know, how we discuss our relationship with our colonizers, right? And that's a really difficult thing. How, you know, and just even getting to the point, like, wait a minute, where Vietnamese can maybe self-reflect, wait a minute, what did I internalize, right? How much of the sort of the colonizer PR did I internalize, right? And propaganda, you know, that was something that Koreans did, because, you know, that was very real there. There was a very similar experience, but I think it, you know, there was a lot of effort to sort of decolonize that. There's just a lot of things. I think how, you know, Korea deals with immigrants, or AKA expats, and that's a whole nother conversation, like who gets entitled to be called expats and who gets, why are they not immigrants, you know? And I think how, you know, immigrants are treated and managed and in Vietnam is also very different too. So the, yeah, it is, I think about Vietnam, and on one hand, it is like, it's just this mosaic of different tribes scattered all, and they kind of each, they each have their own recipe of history, you know, and it's like, and their identity.
Well, this is so vital to the development of Vietnam, as the conversation goes, where we're constantly chasing this shiny bullet that Korea has done, which is this. There is an ownership, an ownable export coming out of Korea on many fronts, whether it's the K-pop, K-drama, the cars, there's these ownable exports. And we talk about that with, I talked about that with other branding strategists, and I have a 3-4 man branding strategy podcast coming up soon to talk about it. So I'm glad that we're covering it here. What do you think would be or can be Vietnam's ownable export in the same vein as K-pop and K-dramas and cars that are coming out of Korea?
Well, so much. Vietnam is rich in natural resources. And so there is so much that we can own. Coffee, obviously, we know, finally we see the rise of Vietnamese American entrepreneurs, right? And there's one, chocolate. I mean, there's so much. you know, most importantly, the fragrance industry, right? So our colonizers, you know, where did they get all of their extracts for all these fragrances and built billion-dollar industries upon, right? So we could have a lot of, we could own that.
We don't have that, do we? Is there any big product fragrances coming out of Vietnam?
No, I have an idea where, like, you know, after I'm doing what I do now, if I decide to do another startup venture, is almost just take the exact same French fragrance, not change the formula, but just rebrand it and just keep the exact same ingredients inside, because so much of it comes from botanicals extracted from Vietnam that grows there. But I think we can certainly own that. You know, there's so many industries that I think we can scale in successfully, because there's just so many natural resources that can drive this sort of innovation, and these channels already exist. I think culturally speaking, with storytelling and entertainment, you know, I'm less, you know, educated there, but, you know, how to support that is, you know, what I can say is in Korea, the government was really strategic in supporting that, because they knew that was very important, because that drives cultural value, PR, and it all is an ecosystem that feeds one another. So I think that if that could be accomplished, that will allow all these incredible Viet creators, you know, to rise. And I think if they're, if we can take that sort of censorship out, so there's a fear, that fear is removed from storytelling, I think that could really help too.
Yeah, I would agree. My areas of research don't permit me to speak to this as much as I'd like to, but I think that the aspect of history, of intangible cultural history, so when we talk about stories, when we talk about the nature of Vietnamese identity, that I think can be a valuable source of export, right? And whether it's coming from the country or it's coming from those outside of the country who might have ties to that identity. Ken, the reason you and I met was because of a mutual colleague, and I'm thinking about his work, right? Phuong Nguyen and his recent book, The Bronze Drum. That kind of storytelling, those events are familiar to Vietnamese folks, to the diaspora, but they're not familiar for a lot of people outside of that in the English-speaking world. And yet, I'm amazed to see that novel, the historical novel, now coming out and doing so well, telling this very important story about that one historical episode of the Trung sisters and their rebellion against the Han. It resonates, right? There are tales that resonate that that are analogous to the kinds of stories that we hear about in other countries and their histories. To me, it's interesting that happens at the same time that we see an uprising in what would be the United Kingdom of Boudica against another imperial power, the Romans. That happens in the same century, and on opposite sides of the globe. But there are these kinds of histories that might be fodder for people to get inspired, to want, it might drive tourism and interest in Vietnamese culture and people coming to places in the country to visit, not just to go and hang out on the beach, but to actually experience deeper parts of the cultural history. That to me is another draw that I think can be in some ways commodified. We have examples elsewhere within Southeast Asia of just that kind of thing happening. Everybody's heard of Angkor Wat, and we know that millions of people go and visit Cambodia because of that famous archaeological site. There are places in Vietnam that are just as old, if not older, that have these rich tapestries of history and cultural heritage. And perhaps that can be part of what Vietnam starts to put on the table for the world to see.
This all starts with the conversation for vision. And this is happening in Vietnam right now, led by former ambassador of Vietnam to the EU. She's spearheading this sort of conversation, this dialogue. She's creating a summit, I think, for 2024 on the mission of rebranding modern Vietnam. And this includes people in the diaspora as well. Mm-hmm. And her biggest task is to figure out, you know, these branding strategists that I brought on to her to have her have dialogue is talking about what is the ownable exports? What are the things that we can capture? And I think fragrance, what you brought up, Tuan, is a very interesting thing that we can, you know, alcohol is being, you know, these botanical gins that are being harvested from the people in the highlands and stuff like that. It's, you know, we're at the cusp of the development of Vietnam, but we don't have what you brought up as well. Both of you brought up, we don't have government intervention. We don't have the government help that the Vietnamese government lacked the vision to put their foot and their money where it counts.
My God, absolutely. And that's just so important. You know why companies and startups fail? One of the biggest reasons is ops, lack of operational procedures and systems. And, you know, information and support can flow, and exchange of information can flow freely and easily. And having all of that support is just so critical. And I think without that support, it's really going to be very difficult to achieve the success that I think we're all defining here. Because there's so many ownable commodities and services that we can excel in, you know, and I think just what we just discussed here is just the tip of the iceberg. I'm sure right after this podcast, we're going to all text each other. Oh, wait, this, and this, you know, there's so much. And, you know, I know that like there's, you know, in the fashion industry, textiles, right? Vietnamese silk, right? And it's beautiful how it's made. It's almost like soft leather. You know, when it's done, it's dyed in a natural process, black. And, you know, it's the whole process is just so fascinating. There's so many things that we can scale. And I think without that operational support in resources that the government can provide, it's going to be really hard.
So I have a question for both of you. I'm curious what you see as moving forward. That the question of ops, right? Is that something that the government is actively thinking about and recognizes as a potential gap and inviting folks? Because from what I've experienced, what I've seen in going back to Vietnam now repeatedly for the past 15 years or so, almost 20 years, things are constantly changing. And I feel as though the amount and degree of foreign investment has just been increasing every time I go back. There's all kinds of development, all kinds of change. And I wonder how much of that is being welcomed and invited. And what we might anticipate moving forward.
That's a great question. Let me start by answering this, that what they do is sometimes not public information. It's not something that they promote. And I think it has something to do with optics where, well, we're a communist country. We don't want to seem like we're all about academic freedom or opening up our doors too far out, and then things will get a little out of control. But they do make the effort. For example, in the 90s, the prime minister at the time went to the East Coast and got a tour by, I think it was Larry Summers, which is the president at the time for Harvard. And they went up and down the coast, MIT, Yale, they went to all these, and they got to get a glimpse of how to sort of instill this idea of academic freedom, but they have to do it in a way where they can still manage and control the way that they manage and control the society. But they do make these trips and they do put the effort in to kind of developing this. They have representation here in LA. I went to a Chamber of Commerce LA thing, and they brought in their biggest lieutenants for business from the government, and they mingled with the Vietnamese business community here in Southern California. That was a huge thing. So wow. I'm slowly discovering that they're very active about it. They're just not public about it. Now, when you do that, especially in the 90s when they did that, they brought over a team of Harvard public policy people, I think from the Kennedy School, and they started to kind of like grow this movement with the government and the Kennedy School. And so they created a base for the Harvard public policy in Vietnam. That morphed into today's Fulbright. And so the roots of improving the country from these economic models and these ideas of the West it is constantly being brought in, but it's not being, I don't think it's heavily publicized, because we would have all known about it, right? Like, just regular people that are curious like us, we should know. And then recently they had some initiative to bring to light the idea of entertainment coming, going back and forth, whether it's US to Vietnam, Vietnam to US. They're really getting involved with the implementation of, let's move artists back and forth and see where this takes us. So it's really happening, but the PR side of this is not, it's not where it should be.
Yeah, I, you know, that's really, thank you for all of that education, Kenneth. And, you know, I think it's important, while this really is happening, and these photo opportunities and these meetings are taking place, and that really sort of speaks to the PR and optics sides, what's happening publicly. What I care about, and I think what most of us care about, is the implementation, right? And so the call to actions that really come out of that, and make, because we will see the impact right now. I think right now, even like setting up business, it still feels like the wild, wild west there. The credit system, financial institutions, banking, you know, just all of these important infrastructure items that really sort of needs to be in place. And speaking to what you're doing with the academic freedom and education, is like, we need to see the real programs being meaningfully funded, the right people being installed, and that this is being taken, you know, action upon strategically, you know, and having real impact.
Yeah.
That, what are you going to say?
Well, I, as you were both talking, a couple of other things occurred to me that I've seen, and I don't know if you're familiar or how much you know about it, but the last time I was there, and this is now 3 years after I was there because of COVID, I was there this past summer. I noticed a lot of electric cars on the road that I had not seen at all. And I started to do a little bit of digging. I come to find out, I think it's a local Vietnamese company that is producing these cars. And actually that is, I think they're hoping to, they're aspiring to expand outside of the country as well.
They're here.
Oh, they're here.
VinFast is everywhere.
Oh.
VinFast in California, all the big malls have a storefront.
Do they?
Just like Tesla, you know, Century City Plaza here in LA, South Coast, you name it. They have, I think, 50 locations, distributors, locations. So they're here.
Wow. Yeah. I live in the Midwest. I don't see them here. I'm insulated. But that to me is fascinating to think about. I didn't anticipate having to see that or being able to see that.
I went to the LA car show in November here in LA, and they had this massive island. You know, these islands cost a lot of money. That island that they had was not anything smaller than like a Toyota, or, you know, they have big pockets to really back it. They come from this group called the Vin Group, which is a bunch of real estate developing outfit in Vietnam, and it's ran by, it's like the Korean, is it called Chabos. So it's becoming like that in Vietnam, where, you know, groups of family members that are running these big conglomerates that, you know, produce cars and real estate and all these wonderful things.
Right. So lots of changes happening afoot.
Yeah, I mean, there are.
The other thing that occurred to me was just that we hadn't mentioned was food, right?
Yeah, that was my next question.
Popularity. I mean, Tuan, you mentioned how your family members from Korea would always want to go have Vietnamese food. I'm thinking about how that has become part of the sort of American culinary consciousness more and more in recent years.
Absolutely. You know, I think my friends know, because, you know, I talk about it all the time, but I feel like Vietnam should be a culinary destination like Italy is, right? There's so much to learn. And I am, of course, so concerned that this will disappear into history. But you can go there, and like right now, if you go to Italy, you can learn these techniques, right, of cooking, and it's amazing that what you can learn there. And people really love it, and it really drives tourism, appreciation of the culture, and cultural value goes up. I mean, you'll see it at the on menu prices, right? I mean, Italian dough making food items are this price and Vietnamese are this price, but they're still labor intensive, involves a lot of skill. But being able to go there, and I mean, how fun would it be like for the Vietnamese podcast to arrange an incredible tour group, an education group where we can come and we can learn how to make rice paper, how they do it, how they dry it in the sun. It's so beautiful, right?
Yeah.
There are so many things there that could get lost. And that's just one food item.
Right.
What Vietnamese fish sauce really is, you know, and how that is really learned, and learning what, you know, that N means is the nitrogen amount, the higher the nitrogen amount, 40N up to 60N, the how it quality, but how they're able to create that liquid gold.
Yeah.
There are so many food items there to yeah. learn from Northern, Central, and South. But Sapa, it's, I mean, we could just talk forever. The amazing, all the amazing things that we could learn. And
yeah.
It's a huge opportunity.
So that to me kind of reflects what we were talking about earlier, all the different identities, the different cultural backgrounds, ethnicities of this very rich tapestry of Vietnamese culture and society, whether it's in Vietnam or outside of it, all of that food and the food ways, the practices, the dishes, the recipes, that reflects those various communities, right? So for me, that is also a potential area that could be ripe for exploration. And I love your suggestion. Ken, I think there should be a field trip. Maybe you can take the three of us on this tour.
I would, you know what? We should definitely put something together, because there's the gin, you know, Song Khai.
Song Khai.
I think if we did a tour of Song Khai, there's Sunfish Sauce, you know, Danny Tran an OC, and we could... Literally, we could go and form a trip. And then, Nam, I know you have some archaeological sites that we can visit. And this could be a thing where the three of us can go and lead sort of a group of 20 to 30 people and organize maybe a 2-week, 10-day thing in Vietnam. And the three of us can partner up and do, oh my God, this would be absolutely amazing.
And to me, the fascinating aspect of that too would be the time depth. As an archaeologist, I would be interested to see the roots, the how you trace back those identities and those food ways. So I've always been curious. When do we start seeing pho? When do we start seeing various kinds of dishes in different parts of the country? How much of that is local?
Fresh rice noodles, right? For our pho, that's an amazing process, right? This could be so cool. And then cookbooks could be built off of this. There's just all of these things that could you know, just be a foundation for growth of ideas and supporting it and getting it out there into the world and rising our cultural value and just crediting, you know, Vietnam, how much is happening there. I think this trip would be incredible. To have it documented would be wonderful. So we can share it.
And by the way, you could complement that with a side journey to South Korea and replicate the framework, right? Because I think the same kinds of questions can be asked.
My God, there's just so much more to talk about too. You know, like, I love the comparison of like Vietnamese fish sauce and soju over the last century.
Wow.
How, because of scarcity, how both of them had to be sort of commercialized and, you know, using lower quality ingredients, and there's sort of a return, you know, to that. So like what's happening, you know, how we used to make soju in Korea before, we're returning to those practices and reconnecting there. We're seeing that in fish sauce. It's just, there's so much more. I think the military effort, the American intervention, how it just went in different directions. This is such a rewarding and conversation, and it's so rich. I could talk about this anytime.
We'll do the part two, because the military intervention is very interesting to me as well. Because in the 50s, the U.S. was in Korea, but the outcome was very different than Vietnam, U.S. being in Vietnam.
I want to know why.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ken, for organizing this, for conceiving of this podcast.
Thank you so much, Ken, and for facilitating this introduction. To Nam, it is such an honor to meet you.
Likewise. Likewise. Like I said at the beginning, it's like staring into a mirror. And I have so many more questions for you specifically, but we'll save it for
another time. Yeah, I think that the second time we do this, we'll have it, you know, where you two prepare questions for each other. And, you know, I think that would be another way to go. Would love to talk about the military interventions, the comparison of that, talk about, you know, more of the food side. You know, there's a lot more that we can really get into.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, oh my God. And I think the strength of Korea, and it's just, we got to talk about really what it means, like, you know, with the Korean government, how Korean males serve in the military. Like, why is it that I am almost motivated to serve because I never did? I'm so proud, you know, and you know, how that can sort of translate. What can the two countries learn from one another?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I think that's, anyway, thank you so much, Ken. This has been amazing.
Thank you, Tuan. Thank you, Nam.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.